Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bratbold, and Judge Larson. The Honorable Peter M. Reyes presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, October 24th, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today. Three are set for oral argument here. And before we begin, I just want to thank the people here at Mitchell Hamlet College for hosting our oral arguments today. We're delighted to be here. I am particularly delighted because I am a grad of Mitchell Hamlin. And so this is a little bit of a homecoming for me. And this is actually the first time in the 10 plus years that I've been on the bench that I will have argued here at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. So the first case that we have on our calendar today is case number A24-0825, State of Minnesota versus Marcus Devante Harvey, and my apologies if I mispronounce that name. Feel free to correct me, counsel. We will have 15 minutes for oral arguments by appellant's counsel, followed by 15 minutes by respondent's counsel, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant's counsel if they so choose. When you approach the podium, please adjust the microphone and speak clearly into it, announcing your name and the party that you are representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent appellant, the state of Minnesota. This is a state's pretrial appeal of a district court's order suppressing evidence. In a state's pretrial appeal, the state must show two things: critical impact of the district court's order and that the district court erred. The factual findings are reviewed for clear error, and the errors of law are reviewed de novo. There's largely no dispute as to the facts, but there is dispute as to both of the other factors, that being whether there was critical impact or whether there was error. In this case, respondent Mr. Harvey was driving a vehicle in Savage in the winter in 2022. Officer Nelson saw driving conduct, ran the plates, and saw expired registration, so he stopped the car. When he approached the car, Mr. Harvey was driving, and he smelled the overwhelming odor of marijuana. Ultimately, Mr. Harvey admitted to smoking a blunt, and the officer called for a drug recognition evaluator who came to the scene and determined that Mr. Harvey was under the influence of a controlled substance. So his blood was drawn, submitted to the BCA, and the BCA found evidence of delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinols and two metabolites of delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinols. So Mr. Harvey was charged with driving under the influence of a controlled substance. Immediately before trial, the district court judge suppressed the evidence of the BCA test. The district court judge found that under Rule 403, it would be unfairly prejudicial because the state did not need that evidence because he had admitted to smoking a blunt 4 hours prior and there was the smell of marijuana. So the district court judge believed that the evidence of the Delta 9 was unfairly prejudicial.
So, counsel, to put this question in light of the first issue on appeal, which is whether there's a critical impact, I think the district court also relied on a third piece of evidence to say that there was no critical impact to the exclusion of this evidence. And that was the failure, the officer's opinion that there was impairment based on the field sobriety tests. Am I right about that?
He did not say that.
Okay.
He found that there was a failure to comply with the expert witness disclosures. That was the second basis for exclusion.
But on the critical impact.
On the critical
impact. Right. I'd like you to get to the first issue, if you would.
The critical impact.
Yeah.
So under the critical impact, the state must show two things in this case. Well, I mean, we have venue and whatnot, but we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was, Mr. Harvey was driving under the influence, that's one part, of a controlled substance, that's the second part. And the only way that we can really show that there was a controlled substance is the BCA blood test. That's it.
Can't you show that by the testimony or his statement that he was smoking marijuana 4 hours before driving?
That is evidence that's corroborative that goes towards having ingested marijuana prior to this, but that doesn't prove an actual controlled substance. And what he admitted to was smoking a blunt 4 hours prior.
So I help me out on that, counsel, and I don't mean to interrupt Judge Reyes, but it seems to me that whether we're looking at Mr. Harvey's statements, admitting that he had used marijuana 4 hours earlier, whether we're looking at a drug, at a blood test, we're still, the state's ultimate goal at trial is going to be to ask the jury to draw the inference, right, that Mr. Harvey was under the influence at the time of driving.
Correct. Yes. Yeah,
of a controlled substance. Yes. At the time of driving. So both pieces of evidence require the inference, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
All the
so back to critical impact. Help me out on that. Why is it, if you've got all of this abundance of evidence from which the jury can draw an inference?
Well, so critical impact is a demanding standard, but it doesn't mean that the state's case is completely destroyed if you don't have it. It's if it seriously impedes the prosecution, that's sufficient to meet the critical impact standard. So it is a more relaxed standard. And there's really no compelling way to argue that the state is not significantly impacted by the district court's suppression of the blood test, which is the only evidence, actual scientific evidence, of what the controlled substance was in Mr. Harvey's blood. Simply because someone says they smoked a blunt 4 hours prior doesn't mean that they smoked marijuana. It doesn't mean that that was all they smoked. And it doesn't prove anything about what is in the person's blood. Marijuana differs slightly from alcohol in that way. Because there's alcohol, you smell alcohol, you admit to drinking alcohol, there's going to be alcohol in your blood. Marijuana isn't that way. So here, the only evidence of an actual controlled substance in his body is the BCA blood test.
Are you saying that you can smoke marijuana, but it may not be in your blood system?
I'm saying you could, yes. I'm saying you could smoke something that you believe is marijuana and it isn't. I'm saying you could smoke something that is marijuana and you can end up with all of these tetrahydrocannabinols in your blood. You can also smoke something that is similar to marijuana, but isn't. So for instance, hemp is not marijuana. Smells like marijuana, looks like marijuana, but isn't marijuana. So marijuana seems simple on the surface, but as soon as you get into actually proving marijuana, it's very different. And the BCA blood test, again, is the only evidence, the only scientific evidence of what is in that person's blood. And in this case, for instance, Mr. Harvey admitted to smoking a blunt 4 hours prior. So therefore, the district court judge said, well, you have that. That's really all you need. But at the contested omnibus hearing, he tried to blame then the odor of marijuana on his girlfriend. So it's not like we're going to go to trial and have a clean record with Mr. Harvey admitting that he smoked marijuana. He may not admit it at all. He may blame his girlfriend. He may say he smoked something that wasn't marijuana, but smelled like marijuana, something a lot like hemp, which is identical. It's literally identical with the exception of the THC content of it.
Counsel, assume for the moment that we agree with you and there was critical impact to the district court's determination. How do you survive the second stage and gain a reversal, which is you've got to show abuse of discretion, right, in excluding the evidence?
Yes, and it's an abuse of discretion under 403. Again, I mean, it is very similar. Under 403, it's an abuse of discretion because it's not unfairly prejudicial. It is the only evidence of the controlled substance.
Well, help me out with that. I guess I'm not necessarily following you. You might think it's the same analysis, but I'm not following your point. So it seems to me that the Rule 403 analysis is uniquely entrusted to the district court's discretion. In fact, when I try to find a case, an appellate decision that has reversed a district court under a Rule 403 analysis, it's very few and far between, if any. So Help me out, counsel. I mean, this district court very carefully considered and had a couple of reasons why it felt that this evidence had to be excluded. And why was that an abuse of discretion?
Well, first, he really only discussed two, that being the odor of marijuana and the admission to smoking a blunt 4 hours prior. So that...
Well, you're talking about the whether there's cumulative evidence and therefore whether you were otherwise able to prove your case. But setting that aside for a moment, the district court had other reasons for excluding the evidence, right?
That it was...
I'm not trying to make a guess. So the district court certainly talked about the state's obligation to produce an expert opinion to link the results of the blood test to the state's burden of proof in this case, and the need to disclose that in advance of trial, which did not occur here. So how do you respond to that?
So the district court analyzed those separately. The district court did not conflate the expert witness with the relevance of the blood test. The district court found that this was expert testimony that required an expert report. There wasn't an expert report, so he's excluding it on that basis, period. That's separate from 403. He separately ruled on 403.
Okay.
So under the expert...
You need to show, though, right, an abuse of discretion under either of
yes.
those prompts.
And under, yes. And under... So going to the expert right. witness issue... Mm-hmm. He did not consider any of the factors that he's required to consider if there is a discovery violation under the Supreme Court's decision in Lindsay. There's four factors. He didn't consider any of them. That's an abuse of discretion. And primarily, even if there's, and this is assuming that there's a discovery violation.
You're talking about the Lindsay test?
Yes.
Right. Well, I'm curious, counsel, so do you concede then under the district court's analysis that the district court was right in assessing that expert testimony was required in this case?
No.
Okay. So
not at all.
Why would we even get to the Lindsay analysis? I'm trying to understand.
If you find that that this is an expert witness, you then go to Lindsay. I don't think you go there. You shouldn't go there because it wasn't an expert witness. The state didn't proffer the BCA as an expert witness. The state didn't need this as an expert witness. The BCA was simply testifying to the blood test and what was in Mr. Harvey's blood. That's it. That's not expert testimony.
Why is that not expert testimony? I mean, the testimony that the BCA agent was going to provide went to scientific evidence and went to testimony. It appears, just speaking for myself, it appears that that's not testimony that a layperson would be able to understand. So why isn't that considered expert testimony?
No cases have found that that is expert testimony in Minnesota because she's testifying to what is in his blood and that's it. She's not giving an opinion testimony as far as doing any kind of retrograde extrapolation, which is the Edstrom case from the Court of Appeals. So the state was not using her as an expert to present expert testimony.
But that precisely why the district court got to the 403 analysis, which is that you were not offering any expert testimony to actually explain this test. And because marijuana is different from alcohol in terms of its appearance in the blood, that it was unfairly prejudicial to just have a test result submitted to the jury without any explanation when it's possible that the jury would think that a test for marijuana is the equivalent of a test for alcohol, which I think, as you were discussing, is different. Those chemicals interact with the blood differently. Why wasn't the absence of you providing expert testimony to explain that report not in 403 category? Because I do think that the two rulings interact with each other in that way.
So the case law finds that, and I'm comparing even to alcohol, when you have both a mixture of a under the influence case and an over the number case, if you will. So those are two different charges. Now, with marijuana, you only have an under the influence. You don't have an over the number. But comparing it even to the alcohol cases, this court has found that, one, it is critical impact to suppress the alcohol test in an under the influence only prosecution.
But my understanding, and you can correct me if I don't understand the science correctly, is that you can have THC appear in a blood test many, many days after you've actually consumed the THC, which is different from alcohol, where within a relatively short period of time, that chemical has left your bloodstream. And in my understanding of the district court's decision, that was what they found troublesome, was if there wasn't going to be expert testimony to explain that difference for how the two chemicals interact with our bloodstreams.
So the BCA would not have gone to show that Mr. Harvey was actually under the influence. That would have been the driving conduct, the admission, the drug recognition expert. That's the under the influence component. The BCA blood test shows simply what is that controlled substance. And without the BCA report, the state cannot prove what that controlled substance was.
So back to whether an expert opinion is needed or required, I noted that, and I'm sorry, Judge Reyes, our remaining time?
There's 45 seconds.
Oh, okay, so I'll just try this and perhaps you'll need to answer it on rebuttal. It seems to me that the state's offer of proof during trial was that the BCA agent would not only testify to the results of the blood test, but would also explain what the test results mean. I'm directly quoting from the transcript. Is that expert testimony? And I'm really alluding back to Judge Larson's question.
I mean, it would depend on the extent of that testimony. Certainly it could get into expert testimony, but on its face, no, that's not expert testimony. Mm-hmm. And unless there's any other questions, I'll just be back on rebuttal.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may begin. You will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the respondent this morning, Marcus Harvey. We are requesting that this court dismiss the state's appeal because the state has not established that the district court's ruling will have a critical impact on the state's ability to prosecute its case. Alternatively, if this court reviews the merits of the state's argument, this court should affirm the district court's order because the district court acted well within its discretion and the state has not met its heavy burden of establishing an abuse of discretion. I would like to start this morning with the critical impact issue, but I'm happy to pivot to the merits of the case whenever the court would like me to do so. The state has not met its burden of establishing critical impact for two important reasons. First, evidence that Mr. Harvey had marijuana in his system was merely cumulative evidence. Mr. Harvey admitted he smoked marijuana. Law enforcement observed that he showed signs of impairment, and law enforcement also observed the smell of marijuana emanating from his car.
How does observation of impairment relate to THC in a person's blood? In a person's blood?
Yeah. So to address the state's point on that, Mr. Harvey admitted that he smoked marijuana. The jury instructions state that marijuana is a controlled substance. So the jury does not have to make that determination. I'm not sure where the state is getting that argument from. All the state has to prove is that Mr. Harvey had used marijuana and he admitted to doing so. So there was not a requirement that the jury had to dig through medical records or, you know, the reports to determine what actually the controlled substance was.
But doesn't the state have to prove that he consumed a controlled substance? That's part of their burden of proof, right?
That's true.
Okay, and so how do they prove that he had a controlled substance in his body?
So his admission that he had smoked marijuana.
Okay, but
so counsel, would you draw out that what was Mr. Harvey's statement, or what do you suggest the state would have offered into evidence?
So the state would have offered into evidence the law enforcement's body camera and law enforcement's testimony that Mr. Harvey admitted to smoking marijuana within 4 hours of driving.
Mr. Harvey's words, counsel.
I smoked a blunt
four hours ago. All right.
That's
is that
correct.
Getting back to Judge Reyes's question, is that the same?
I believe it's the same. And I think if Mr. Harvey would have denied or his defense was that the state didn't prove that he had used a controlled substance, I think then that would have opened the door and the 403 analysis would change, because the evidence from the blood sample would become a lot more relevant and less prejudicial if the issue at trial was actually whether or not he had a controlled substance in his system. His defense at trial was that his driving was not impaired and that his driving conduct was based on the weather, and that's why he was crossing over the middle line. So the idea that if he would have all of a sudden brought up the defense that he had not used a controlled substance, that the state would have then not been able to present evidence regarding what was in his system, I think that's wrong. I think that would have opened the door at that point for the state to then ask the judge to allow that again.
But couldn't he have argued that, you know, I said a blunt. Well, I meant a blunt of hemp. I didn't mean a blunt of marijuana. Couldn't he have argued that? And in fact, I think he insinuated that, well, it was actually from his girlfriend. He also mentioned that he regularly smokes marijuana in the car, and that's why there's an odor of marijuana in the car. So, I mean, it seems like there are a lot of arguments that could have been made as to either contradict or reduce the impact of that statement. So why isn't this not just cumulative, but actually necessary information to provide to the jury to show that he in fact did have a controlled substance in his system, in his body?
Again, our position is that his admission of smoking a blunt within 4 hours, the smell of marijuana and the signs of impairment that the officer observed, all of that establishes that he had marijuana in his system, that he had used marijuana. Again, if his defense at trial would have been, I only smoked hemp, what was in the car?
Well, but we didn't have a trial. This is pretrial.
That's right. So the pretrial order saying that this, again, we're talking about critical impact right now.
Right.
So the critical impact of this ruling based on the evidence we have before us is that there was evidence that he had a controlled substance in his system. The idea, the state's argument regarding what the argument was at the probable cause hearing or the motion to suppress, that was merely whether the state had probable cause to search the vehicle or to expand the stop. So that wasn't necessarily his defense at trial, that he was going to deny the fact that he had used marijuana.
But all the state needs to prove for a critical impact, that is that it would have had a substantial impact. Not that it would have killed their case, but it's a much lower burden than it was before. They just have to show it would have had a substantial impact. In DWI, alcohol-related cases, blood tests are regularly admitted. In fact, that's something that's very, very common. Why wouldn't this have a critical impact when it certainly would have a critical impact in a driving under the influence of alcohol case?
I think there's a big difference between alcohol cases and marijuana cases, because if there was blood tests in an alcohol case, they could actually pinpoint, because there's that 0.08 threshold, you can dictate how impaired somebody is and when they actually drank the alcohol. Versus in a marijuana case like this, as the discussion earlier, the test results don't pinpoint when exactly marijuana was smoked. It can be in a system for up to 30 days, right?
Well, that's for inactive.
Right.
And active components, but active components of marijuana, the testimony would have been that those dissipate within less than 24 hours.
Correct.
So there's a difference, and there are two active components that were found in his blood, as well as inactive components. So inactive components seem to be irrelevant. It's the active components. So why, and I understand your argument and in your briefing about how this is different than alcohol. And I would agree if all we're talking about is quantitative data, because there is no quantitative data of how much marijuana system would make a person impaired. That's comparable to a driving over 0.02 or 0.16. But here it was qualitative data. Is it there or not? Why isn't this similar or the same as a driving under the influence charge for driving under the influence of alcohol, in which all you need is the qualitative, is alcohol in the system or not?
And again, I'll just go back to my original argument that he admitted that he had smoked marijuana, and that was, it would not have been his defense at trial that he did not smoke marijuana, that the state did not prove that element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Did the district court know at the time that it made its ruling that that was not going to be your defense at trial?
That was not in the record. No. But I do believe that as soon as if that became the defense, then the state could have moved the court to reconsider its decision because the situation had changed and it would become highly relevant and probative and less prejudicial for that to come in at that time.
So why is it highly relevant in this pretrial critical impact stage then?
Because as the court correctly found, the state could prove up the fact that he used marijuana by the fact that he admitted that he used marijuana. I mean, I'm going to return to that.
But I understand, but that seems to be a different argument than whether or not the standard is met of whether or not the state can prove that before us, that it would have a substantial impact on their case.
So the lack of the blood test that says he used marijuana will not have a critical impact on the state's ability to prosecute his case because he admitted that he smoked marijuana, plain and simple. That evidence is going to come in at trial. There's a body camera of him saying that. There's no doubt that he used marijuana. That is not the issue going forward in this case. And if it became an issue, then the state could then ask the district court, hey, they are now opening the door for us to introduce this evidence. It is now more relevant and less prejudicial because it is the main issue at trial.
Let's move to the second part. Why is it an abuse of discretion? And the Lindsay factors in particular concern me because the Minnesota Supreme Court has explicitly said that a district court's failure to consider the Lindsay factors, the four Lindsay factors, is an abuse of discretion, therefore a reversible error. Why shouldn't, on that basis, why shouldn't we conclude that it should?
Your Honor, our position is this issue is more of a whether the evidence and the testimony is expert evidence versus whether there's a discovery violation. The first question that this court has to answer is whether the district court abused its discretion by finding that the testimony would be expert testimony under 702.
Is there any comparable case law under DWI, driving under the influence, that holds that expert testimony such as this, or a testimony such as this, is expert testimony?
No, because in every case, they have an expert come in and testify. This is scientific data. It's detailed, especially in the marijuana context. Interpreting scientific test results is expert testimony under the plain language of 702. The state has the burden at this point to present a case to you or some sort of argument of why this is not expert testimony and why this isn't expert material, and the state hasn't done that. Because it was clearly expert testimony, the state then had to provide the defense and the court with the adequate disclosures under the rules of discovery.
And counsel, help me on that. What's the adequate disclosure that's required under the rule? I thought it was production of the laboratory test, which you did receive, right?
Well, I'm not sure if the specific, that's not in the record. I'm not the attorney below.
But the laboratory test is in the record, right?
I believe it was disclosed, but there were no opinions or summary as to what the expert would testify to. And I think that's the most important thing.
And what's your understanding of what the opinion testimony that was offered, you know, an offer of proof by the state? What was the opinion?
Yeah, one would be generally to explain the test results. That is expert testimony. Explaining.
Does it depend on how far the explanation goes?
If the individual testified that there was a positive test for marijuana, and then we get into the 403 issue, because if the expert, the non-expert, were to testify to that, then the defense would have the right to cross-examine regarding why the individual made that conclusion and why there's marijuana in the system, what kind of marijuana, all that sort of thing. And they couldn't answer those questions. So it's that if it is an expert, if it's not an expert, then the individual can't testify to more than that. So then it's prejudicial because they can't answer questions in cross-examination. And if it is an expert,
I guess what I'm trying to draw a point to is to have you respond to appellant's argument. I mean, as I understand the state's argument, they're saying we needed this witness to testify that there was actually a controlled substance in Mr. Harvey's blood at the time his blood was drawn, which was shortly after he stopped driving. That's what they want to offer. Isn't that just explaining to the jury, offering the lab test report, and simply saying this is what it says, as opposed to the next step, which is an opinion about impairment?
My first position is no, that an expert would have to testify to that. And the reason why is if it's not an expert, then that handcuffs the defense as how to cross-examine about that evidence and whether there's foundation for it, whether it's reliable, all of that information that a non-expert couldn't testify to.
So you're familiar, I'm sure, with Minnesota Statute 634.15, mm-hmm. right? And that has specific provisions about the introduction of laboratory analysis or examination and the availability of a witness to testify to it. Why doesn't that undercut the district court's reasoning on this point?
That statute is regarding foundation for the methodology of doing tests. That has nothing to do with an expert testifying regarding the results. So under that statute, another expert could testify regarding someone else's procedures in doing the tests. So the blood draw, we don't need the individual who took Mr. Harvey's blood to come in and testify under 634.15. We can have somebody else testify to that. Mm-hmm. That's what that's about. It's about the methodology and whether there's foundation for it. Now, interpreting the actual test results, we still need experts to do that.
Interpretation that you understand the state offered to use this witness for was?
Well, what the proffer was is to explain the test results, which I see as being more than just saying he had used a controlled substance. And the second part is what Judge Reyes was mentioning was regarding how long it was in his system, how long it could be detected. I don't think a lay witness can testify to that because the defense would then have the right to cross-examine that individual. And there's no foundation for that testimony if they're not an expert and they don't know how the tests work.
But this witness is the same person who actually did the who did the test results and produced the report, right?
That's correct. But the state said that she's not an expert. So if she's not an expert and hasn't provided any information and disclosures regarding what she's going to testify to, which is the requirement and what any attorney needs to be able to properly prepare and cross-examine that witness, that didn't take place. So yes, she was the individual, the state proffered that she was the individual who made the report, but the state admitted that she wasn't an expert. So at that point, I don't know how you would cross-examine somebody regarding the scientific data if she wasn't in fact an expert. There are no more questions. We request that this court either dismiss the appeal or affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like there are no further questions, and we will return back to appellant's counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Todd Zettler again for appellant. Once jeopardy attaches, the state cannot appeal. So the idea that we could come back later and ask the district court to reconsider its decision if it became relevant should be rejected outright. The state has one shot at this, so we have to get it right the first time prior to jeopardy attaching.
Counsel, I do have one question with regard to the critical impact, and that's that you rely on our non-precedential decision in Schultz as an analogous case. And when I look at Schultz, there were some particular facts that were relevant to that case in that the officers were arriving at the accident. And I think the only evidence that they had was the smell of alcohol and the lack of skid marks. Why isn't that dispositive of the, if that's the case you're relying on, why aren't the particular facts in that case dispositive of the critical impact analysis?
I'm not offering Schultz as the definitive critical impact standard. I'm simply offering that as here's one case where this court has found under very similar circumstances that there was critical impact. And really, the case law is clear under the more relaxed critical impact standard as it exists today that the state's case does not have to be completely destroyed. All it has to be is much more difficult to prosecute. And clearly this case would be if we cannot establish what the controlled substance was.
I guess my question is, do you agree that you have a stronger case for intoxication than the case that existed in Schultz without the blood test information, given that the cop actually observed the driving behavior and was able to administer tests and things of that nature?
We have to prove two things, though, and they're separate. So we have to prove that under the influence, which is the drug recognition expert and all that. We also then separately have to prove controlled substance. What was the exact controlled substance? And statements like I smoked a blunt are not sufficient to establish what the actual controlled substance is beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, Mr. Harvey could have conceded this. He could have stipulated this. He could waive his right to a jury trial on this element. There's ways he can do that. He did none of that. So the state is required to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. And the only way to do that on the controlled substance is with the BCA blood test in this case.
Another thing that the district court said, the district court was concerned about, and I understand your differentiation between having to prove a controlled substance and having to prove that Harvey was under the influence. But I think the district court was concerned that the jury might be confused by this evidence because it would be basically scientific evidence and direct evidence of THC in Harvey's blood, that the, in addition to proving controlled substance, it would actually bleed into the under the influence. And why isn't that a legitimate concern?
I'm not suggesting that that's not a legitimate concern. I am suggesting that it doesn't rise to the level of unfair prejudice under Rule 403. And if this court looks to, for instance, State versus Edstrom, which is at 792 Northwest 2nd 105, in that case, which is an alcohol case, the district court, and I'm quoting here, also expressed concern that no amount of scientific testimony offered by Edstrom would be able to mitigate the prejudice. And that's of an alcohol test in an under the influence case. And this court found that relevant evidence is not subject to exclusion unless it poses a risk of unfair prejudice. And this court went on to explain why that was not unfair prejudice in an alcohol case. So those analysis apply equally in this case. And I ask this court to reverse the district court and remand for trial unless there's further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your briefing and your arguments. As always, both of you do an excellent job and we appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.